Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I'm thrilled to have with me again today Dr. Jacqueline Galvin, who, as you probably remember, is Assistant Professor of Anesthesia at the University of Illinois at Chicago and is the Fellowship Director for the Obstetric Anesthesia Fellowship there, and is back to do what will be the first in a two-part series on problems with term pregnancy. And this, of course, is in our ongoing series of multiple podcast episodes on topics in obstetric anesthesia. So this will be part one of problems with term pregnancy, and then we'll do a second part a little down the road. Jacqueline, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me again, Jed.
All right, so let's jump in. We've got a lot to cover, and I think it's all really quite high yield. So what do you think, when you think about kind of problems with term pregnancy, where do you start in your head? What's the kind of starting point you think we should focus on?
That is a great question. So obviously, people that are used to taking care of adults, we tend to focus on the maternal aspect of obstetric care. However, one important factor we can't forget is the fetal care. And so I want to start with there and how that interacts with anesthesia management. And so why is fetal assessment something that an anesthesiologist should know about? So the significance is that in terms of the ASA closed claim database, a large amount of neonatal injury occurs during emergent situations, for example, urgent or emergent cesarean delivery. And what contributes to neonatal injury? Sometimes it's suboptimal care during their delivery. And how does that interact with anesthesia care? So we are not fully understanding what the obstetric providers are talking about, what their terminology means, what actual urgency or in delivery indications means. We can inadvertently choose a suboptimal anesthetic technique that contributes to either maternal or fetal harm. And so to sort of sort through all of that lingo and topics, how can we simplify it? So in 2009, ACOG developed new terminology to describe fetal hard tone tracings, which we'll get into next.
And just for those out there who may not recognize the acronym, Jackie, so the ACOG, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecologists, right?
Correct.
And yes, I believe that's the major, largest organization of obstetricians and gynecologists out there.
Exactly. Okay. And when they put out bulletins or practice guidelines, oftentimes they interact with the ASA, so we're on the same page with them.
Great.
So when we want to look at what are basically moms or babies that are going to be in trouble. So for example, moms that have cyanotic heart disease, things like lupus, renal disease, diabetes, hypertensive disorders, those are potential should be red flags, people that we want to assess. Conversely, things that are acquired during pregnancy, so again, hypertensive disorders, but other things like oligohydramnios, meaning too much amniotic fluid, or the opposite, polyhydramnios, not enough amniotic fluid. We need to sort of be aware of these terminologies so that we can make an appropriate and timely anesthetic assessment.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to skip to things that when you walk on the labor floor, everyone, I guess, probably can visualize the mom with the two straps in the belly and the fetal hard tones going in the back, in the background. So one of the surprising things about that, the external fetal hard tone monitoring, is that it doesn't actually correlate with any physical fetal outcome, so their Apgar scores or umbilical artery pH or cerebral palsy. So even though we ubiquitously think of that as a monitoring tool, it doesn't actually correlate with how the baby is going to physically turn out. However, that's the only thing we have right now that's non-invasive to help the obstetricians make decisions.
Now, Jackie, let me ask you, is this kind of like the parachute where we're never going to have a randomized trial of whether a parachute works or not? Or is this not like that? Is it that really there is no good data for this and it's really just kind of fear of litigation that has us doing it?
That's correct. So probably less the first answer and more that there are some emerging technologies like umbilical artery Dopplers and some other things that are fancy that are down the road that may help actually improve external fetal monitoring with outcomes. But for right now, this is what we have. And yes, the OB doctors need some sort of way to make delivery decisions.
Okay.
Just for example, the sensitivity to detect fetal acidemia is very low, only 26%. So that's just one example that it's not the best monitoring tool, but this is where we're at.
Okay.
So the fetal heart tone tracings are categorized into 1, 2, or 3. So one, category one, is the best, most reassuring. We'll talk about some characteristics in a minute. Category three, meaning that the baby's not doing well, probably moving towards an operative delivery of some sort, either vaginal or C-section, and certainly that involves anesthetic management. Things that can reasonably be done by anesthesiologists: help administer oxygen, help the mom reposition to a left uterine displacement position, treat blood pressure, give fluids, give tocolytics. These are things we can reasonably do during those situations. And then, unfortunately, category two is that black box or gray area of 80% of the tracings where they're not that great, but it's not that bad. And so we're going to talk about what can anesthesiologists do to interact with those kind of in the middle of the road tracings to prevent maternal harm or fetal harm.
That sounds great.
Great. So I think just to get some, to cover the, as you mentioned, high yield basics, right? Fetal heart rates should be between 110 and 160, ideally. When adults get stressed, our sympathetic tone takes over. When babies get stressed, their parasympathetic tone takes over, so they manifest that as a fetal bradycardia. A baby should have good variability, meaning the heart rate goes up and down, especially with fetal movement. And then, of course, there is the fetal heart tone tracings in relation to maternal contractions. So very quickly, because I think they're reasonably testable questions, is that a early deceleration, so when the fetal heart rate dips down at the same time the contraction comes up, that's a normal pattern, and that means a sign of intact fetal neurologic activity. When there's a late deceleration, meaning the fetal heart tone decreases after the uterine contraction, that's generally a bad sign and is a sign of uterine placental insufficiency. And then there's variable decelerations, meaning that the heart rate of the fetus doesn't necessarily correlate with the contractions, and that classically is associated with umbilical cord compression.
Yeah, and you know, Jackie, one way that I was taught that I always like to remember that is that it's the same order as the baby comes out. So the first thing to come out is the head,
yes.
So that's the early. Early decelerations are from head compression, and then the next thing to come out, in theory, is the cord, and so cord compression is the variable, because that's between early and late, and then the late decelerations, the last thing to come out is the placenta, and so placental insufficiency for late decelerations, and so that just always helped me kind of remember which is which.
Great. I really like that. That's a good tip. So now that we've covered the category of tracings, which anesthesia providers caring for laboring patients should be aware of, we covered normal tracings and signs of not normal or ominous tracings. So the question is, what are we going to do with that besides just look at it? So I have a couple of just practical tips for anesthesia management, especially during situations of non-reassuring fetal heart tones or these category two tracings. So one thing I would recommend is go physically see the patient. What does their airway look like? Do you need backup air equipment? What does their back look like? Could you reasonably establish a neuraxial anesthetic rapidly? What's their IV access? I think a highly underrated portion of especially obstetric anesthesia care, oftentimes IV access is difficult to establish in emergent. So if you have a bad IV access in place, you should establish good access. And of course, scary maternal things like pulmonary hypertension. I think early epidural where appropriate. So not everybody needs an epidural when they walk in the door. However, if the patient, again, their tracing is deteriorating from a category 2 to a category 3, establishing an in situ neuraxial is beneficial. However, some tips during that, you want to avoid hypotension or swings in the maternal hemodynamics. So in this situation, unfortunately, I would probably not recommend a CSE during a non-reassuring fetal heart tone situation.
Now, that's saying a lot, because for listeners who were here for the or listened to the debate between Dr. Galvin and Dr. Hofkamp, Dr. Galvin took the nearly always CSE side of the debate. So that's saying a lot. So for these patients, you would actually do just a traditional epidural.
Potentially, or the dural puncture epidural that we discussed, which is just puncturing the dura via CSE technique, not dosing an intrathecal medication, and then titrating the epidural as an epidural.
Sounds good.
And then last, of course, the ACOG does recommend, if it's possible, to monitor the tones before, during, and after any neuraxial placement. Moving on, again, I think if you have an existing neuraxial and the tracing is not looking well, I think you need an honest reassessment of your epidural catheter. Is it working well, or have you been manipulating it all day long, trying to convince yourself that it's working? I think those are situations we can get ourselves in trouble. And if it's not working, we should replace or maybe decide to put a new spinal in the OR if that's indicated.
Okay.
And then lastly, I think, again, an underrated part is really communication with our OBs and our nurses. So really laying down what is their actual delivery plan. Really emphasizing that we might need time for a neuraxial anesthetic and how can they work that into a delivery plan. Sometimes, and I've been in a situation where the tracing is not going well or going to the OR, sometimes there is time to throw in, as I call it, an anesthetic. So that should probably be the most experienced provider and be limited attempts at that. And then lastly, I think we need to be an honest set of our airway assessment and make sure we have a backup airway plan should our neuraxial fail or just not have enough time to set up.
Now, Jackie, how much do you expect or want your residents and fellows to be able to interpret the tracing themselves as opposed to kind of waiting for the obstetricians to tell them what they're seeing and worried about?
That is a great question. Obviously, as an OB anesthesia fellowship director, I'm highly biased towards especially my fellow and my residents. I don't want them to necessarily interpret the tracing, but I expect them to talk frequently with OB providers about the tracings, what their plans are, what are they worried about. That way we hopefully find ourselves not in the situation without an neuraxial and a bad airway and don't have a decent plan set up.
Great.
So the answer is I expect them to know it.
Good. All right. That's good. That's okay. I think certainly something we see enough on anesthesia in training exams and board exams that people are going to have to know it anyway so that they can get those questions right.
Yes, correct. That too.
All right.
Okay. So our next topic, after moving, we'll sort of staying in the fetal realm, is talking a little bit about preterm labor and a periviable birth. So preterm labor is before 37 weeks of gestation, and women that have a history of preterm labor are more likely to have a subsequent preterm delivery. And periviable is generally considered between about like 24 or 25 weeks or so. Obviously, there's a lot of morbidity for the baby, like respiratory distress and intraventricular hemorrhage. The causes are multifactorial and unfortunately, I think, beyond the scope of our talk today. Risk factors we should look at, an intrauterine infection or uterine distension, such as multiple infants. But I kind of want to talk about discuss things that, again, anesthesiologists, what do we need to know? So, for example, if we have a preterm delivery, again, I think we need to be aware of what's the delivery plan, if any. Are they going to stay 24 hours for steroids, or are they going to be admitted to the floor and possibly deliver? I think we need to know the position of the fetus. So if the fetus is anything other than vertex, that means if the preterm labor went into fulminant labor, we're going to the OR. If it's a head-down baby, well, then it's not sort of as we have a little bit of time to make a plan. Again, in these really early deliveries, 24, 25 weeks, the obstetrician may elect to do a classical uterine incision, meaning up and down on the uterus, and that can confer things like more bleeding for the mom, which we will obviously need to interact with.
And why would they opt for that incision, Jackie, over a traditional incision?
That's a great question. So the lower uterine segment is not fully developed at that particular area, which is at that time of gestation in the 24 or 25, that periviable period. So making an incision on that is less favorable than making an incision on the top of the uterus. Sometimes it also has to do with the fetal position as well.
Okay. And then the other thing was you mentioned, do we want to know if they're going to stay for steroids? And the reasoning there, tell me if I'm right, but is that giving steroids, I think most commonly betamethasone, in a fetus that may not yet have developed lung maturity can help develop that lung maturity if they can get, I believe it's 48 hours of steroids that they want to get in.
That is correct. So if that's their plan to get steroids for 48 hours and then deliver, again, that just means we have more time to make a plan. If that's not part of their delivery plan, well, they might have to speed things up a little bit.
Okay, and so steroids are given for anyone in preterm labor between viability and where is the cutoff?
34 weeks is actually the new cutoff. So okay. That was, I think, a more recent studies. Up to 34 weeks, they're eligible for steroids.
Great.
And that confers just better outcomes for the baby. Other just antenatal management things I think we should know about. Sometimes these babies get magnesium, and then tocolysis therapy often consists of nifedipine, indomethacin, but that doesn't prolong the gestation indefinitely. So often they only work for a short amount of time. Then again, we got to start thinking of delivery planning.
Okay, so maybe those tocolytic agents will get you enough time for the steroids or some magnesium you mentioned, which I believe can give some neuroprotection.
Correct.
As well.
Yes.
Okay.
I think two other things that I think want to mention in terms of how we interact with preterm labor. So we may be asked to perform anesthesia for cerclage, which often consists of just a low volume spinal, ideally. Although general anesthesia is not the wrong answer, but that could be done, and a really aggressive monitored anesthesia care or MAC can be performed. But spinal is very reasonable for cerclage. And then lastly, I always encourage my residents and my fellow, when someone's there for preterm labor, I always ask them, what's the MPO status of the mom and what's the fetal lie? So for example, if the mom is eating and the baby is transverse and she goes into fulminant labor, that makes my anesthesia plan a little more difficult. But if, again, the baby is a vertex or head down position and she has a favorable airway, then it doesn't bother me as much if she's actively eating as well. So it just kind of helps you triage and anticipate problems.
Great. And just to clarify for a cerclage, in case anyone doesn't know what that is,
sorry.
It's a stitch through the cervix. Is that right? To try to hold it closed?
Basically, yes. And there are some other therapies that go along with it, like progesterone, that can help mitigate the chance of going into preterm labor as well.
Okay. So in terms of preventing preterm labor, the kind of long-term approach, if you wanted to really try to tie someone over, would be a cerclage. Other than that, giving the tocolytic agents can buy you some time, but usually not a ton.
Correct.
Okay. And what about tocolytics? Do you want to give us a little information on?
Sure.
You mentioned a couple. Are there others that might be used and kind of what any potential adverse effects are?
Great. So I think one, again, very testable concept is your beta-adrenergic agonist, primarily terbutaline. It's always on test questions and in terms of what are the side effects. So the side effects are pulmonary edema, hypotension, tachycardia, hyperglycemia, and hypokalemia. Always on test exams. As I mentioned, nifedipine is also an effective tocolytic. Magnesium, surprisingly, is not. So its main role, as we already discussed, is for fetal neuroprotection.
Okay, sounds good. So those are the main ones you'll see. I totally agree with you. I've seen even on my MOCA questions, I've seen that question about terbutaline and the side effects. So that's a very common one. All right. And then what about any kind of, you mentioned a few, but any other practical tips? I guess you mentioned that you want to make sure you know what the management plan is. You want to know the NPO status and the fetal lie. And then anything else you kind of tell your residents and fellows to keep in mind?
Sure. And I don't want to stand on my soapbox or anything, but sometimes the patients will get admitted to L&D for observation for preterm labor. And sometimes the thought is that we don't have to worry about that because they'll get their steroids, they'll go home or whatnot. But I've been in a situation where all of a sudden they're observation and then 5 minutes later we're going to the OR. So I think it's a very practical and reasonable thing to make sure we see the patient, do a full H&P, make sure there's nothing that would really preclude us from being able to administer a general or regional anesthetic if we had to or were called upon to.
Great. So basically anyone on that labor floor, even if they're there just for observation, should be considered a patient and should be seen and evaluated so you're ready to go if you need to go.
Yes.
Great. What about fever, maternal fever? We hear about this a lot. How worried should we be? What does it mean? What do you do, and how do you worry about a woman with a fever?
Exactly. So I think one of the most interesting about this topic is when you talk about maternal fever, and when it certainly has to be studied, what is the definition? And surprisingly, there isn't one maternal temperature that designates a fever, and often it's institution dependent. So I think ours is 38 degrees Celsius. I don't know if you know your institutional standard, but there's no standard definition, which means from that aspect, it's difficult to study. However, many people think that the mechanism is that there is a mismatch between maternal heat production and heat dissipation. Mm-hmm. Might be a shift in some thermoregulatory mechanisms. It might be related to a non-sterile inflammatory state, particularly associated with interleukin 6 or interleukin 8, or it might actually relate to an actual infection, which during labor is often chorioamnionitis, so infection of the intrauterine cavity, pneumonia is still not off the radar, and pyelonephritis.
All right. I guess the question then is, if a little bit of fever may be kind of normal anyway,
mm-hmm.
how do you know if it's an infection you need to worry about or if it's just a normal fever?
I think that's a good question. And if you are okay, I was going to address that question in the sepsis, snippet at the end of this discussion.
Yep. That's fine. We'll come back to it.
Great. Sorry about that. But I think one important discussion in the literature is this association between labor epidural analgesia and maternal fever.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
There definitely is an association between that, between putting in labor epidural and the mom developing a fever. Not necessarily, though, causation. So that is really one of the main concerns, and to address one of your questions, is that the main concern was, does putting an epidural make a mom have a fever, and does that mean she has an infection? And the soft answer is not necessarily. So we know there's an association, but the association may be really more related to the mom's request for labor epidural. So as you can imagine, a mom that's having a dysfunctional labor, a difficult time with cervical dilation, the baby's not descending, labor's going on for hours and hours and hours, that's really maybe the underlying mechanism why the mom asks for an epidural and why she develops a fever later on.
Right.
So who are these women that are most likely to have labor dystocia or dysfunctional labors? So women that have large infants, that have any sort of cephalopelvic disproportion, maternal obesity, unfortunately, these long inductions of labor with unfavorable cervix. So that might be a clue that those are the patients that might develop fevers during labor, but might also be asking for labor analgesia as well. So they kind of self-select into that group, for lack of a better description.
Okay.
But the implications is, of course, that if the mom develops fever, right, she goes through a whole workup, might get unnecessary antibiotics, might have an unnecessary instrumented delivery or a C-section. And, of course, for the baby, it's an important thing to recognize, because they then might also get unnecessary antibiotics and workups and, you know, LPs if the mom had dealt with a fever during labor. So it's an important topic, but not fleshed out just yet in the literature.
Okay. So let's say for a minute that it is an infection. What are the infections that we tend to see in term pregnant women, and what do we think in terms of how we work them up?
Sure. So one of the most common infections is chorioamnionitis, or just plain chorio. As we said, it's an infection of the endometrial cavity. Signs, again, maybe maternal fever, a new onset maternal tachycardia, a new onset fetal tachycardia. Again, we're knowing that the fetal heart tone baseline characteristics come into play. Uterine tenderness and a foul-smelling amniotic fluid discharge. So the mechanism is that, especially once the mom's been ruptured for a prolonged amount of time, especially more than 12 hours, your normal perineal and vaginal tract flora gain access to the uterus, and then that develops as an infection. Important consequences of that are preterm labor, placental abruption, uterine atony, because the uterus is just sick and can't contract down well, which confers risk of postpartum hemorrhage, and unfortunately, a risk of cerebral palsy.
Okay, so that's not good.
And that is It often doesn't get to that degree, to that level of drama, but it should. It's an important association, unfortunately.
Okay, and so if we suspect chorio, then obviously we're giving antibiotics. Anything else that we're doing?
I think especially when a mom is going for C-section, oftentimes the acidotic environment may make our local anesthetics that we give not effective, right? Because our local anesthetics are weak bases, and if they're protonated by the acidotic environment, they don't cross the membranes, you know, all those good things we learn in medical school.
Right.
So at the end of the day, they might not work. So what are things you can do? So if you're 2% lidocaine, you definitely need to add your bicarb with it, right, to lower the pH and make it more neutral. Our practice here is to add 100 mics of fentanyl epidural in addition to our local anesthetic. I would also consider, again, something else that doesn't need bicarb, like chloroprocaine. It's very concentrated, very lipophilic. Also, you may want to consider that as an alternative measure to make sure your epidural works so that you're not going to sleep.
Okay. Sounds good. So that's chorio.
Yeah.
What other infections do you think about?
Sure. So other infections that are less common, pyelonephritis, but unfortunately kidneys become mechanically displaced by the uterus, or being predisposed to kidney stones and things like this. So that may be a problem. Respiratory tract infections. So for example, when H1N1 was a thing, there's a lot of women who were unfortunately had pneumonia and other things related to that. So that's really intrapartum infections. And then, of course, postpartum infections are related to mainly like surgical site infections, unfortunately.
Okay. And so then obviously if an infection is getting bad enough, we may end up with a septic patient.
Correct. And to get back to your original question, I appreciate your letting me defer it till now.
Of course.
One of the main issues with sepsis in maternal care is that unfortunately the SIRS criteria don't necessarily aren't applicable to pregnant patients for a number of reasons, right? We expect some degree of tachycardia, right, in moms. We expect some degree of low blood pressure. We expect, as we mentioned, a little bit of elevation of pressure. The white cells do go up during labor. So we can't apply those diagnostic criteria to pregnant women. So oftentimes they're not diagnosed until it's too late and now they're in sepsis.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, again, an area of interest in OB anesthesia that needs more, you know, development, and people are certainly working on that. But I guess our role is to be, again, aware of these infections, aware that the criteria for SIRS don't match pregnant women, and try to keep our eye out so we can help resuscitate and care for these patients.
Okay. And similarly, even as we move to QSOFA, I would imagine the same thing would hold. You're looking at tachypnea, which, again, is pregnant
right.
You're going to have anywhere. You're looking at hypotension, which, again, relatively lower blood pressures anyway. And then the only one that I guess would apply would be altered mental status, which shouldn't be present, of course, just because of pregnancy. So,
right.
But still, you wouldn't be able to use 2 out of 3 of the QSOFA.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll need to read about that after this.
Yeah, so that's, in theory, replacing SIRS as the quick screen for sepsis, but still, I think a lot of people are using SIRS as it slowly makes a transition. Regardless, I think your point holds that neither one is going to be very accurate in pregnant women at term, so what do we do instead?
So that is a great question that's difficult to answer. Again, I think we just need to recognize patients that may be at risk for active infection I think to be aware of change in vital signs. So if the mom's heart rate, for example, was baseline is 60 and now it's 120, well, that's not normal. And I think we need to be part of the care team, part of it, like a perioperative team, that we should not be afraid to go to our obstetric provider and say this patient is changing blood pressure, their heart rate's up, the oxygen saturation is down. Maybe we should consider a pneumonia or something like that.
Okay. So then I guess the question is, if we don't have a great way to differentiate between a normal, let's say, maternal fever and a fever that might be from an infection, do you still place an epidural in a woman with a fever?
That's a great question. And actually, one of our timeout questions prior to placement of labor analgesia, we ask about the last time the mom had a temperature taken and what was that temperature. So just to begin, there really is no large studies that showed, I guess I'm trying to say that overall, that the risk of bacterial meningitis in association with epidural placement is extremely low. So there is that. The incidence is low. We should be aware of active infections. However, if, say, you catch during your timeout that, sure, the mom's last temperature was 38.5, well, then I may take a pause and say, does she have an infection? Have we treated it? And then once the appropriate treatment is on board, I think a Naraxone anesthetic would be okay. However, if you have a florid, fulminant systemic infection and you suspect sepsis, well, probably Naraxone anesthesia is not a great idea.
Right. So this is really going to be kind of a judgment call, taking multiple things into account, not just the fever.
Correct, yes.
Okay. What about in a patient with herpes?
Sure. So just a really quick word on this, just because there's confounding opinions in the literature that herpes has an association with reactivation if you give morphine. And certainly I don't want to give the opinion that we would withhold morphine as an appropriate post-C-section analgesia option with someone who has a diagnosis of HSV. I guess you should be aware that that's out there in the literature, but because morphine is the gold standard of post-operative care for C-section, I would still administer it. But it's an interesting tidbit.
Okay, good to know. So maybe let's move on and talk about, you know, what I think are some of the more common issues that we see with term or near-term pregnancy. So preeclampsia and eclampsia comes up all the time. And how do you think about those?
Sure. So I think, and these are really dense topics, so I just want to hit the highlights. One, that hypertensive disorders are still an important cause of maternal death. So it's an important thing we interact with. Preeclampsia, right, is new onset hypertension after 20 weeks of gestation. Before 20 weeks, that's probably chronic hypertension. And certainly gestational hypertension is in the latter terms of pregnancy, 35, 37 weeks without evidence of end organ damage. The interesting thing about preeclampsia or new developments is that you don't need proteinuria anymore to diagnose preeclampsia. So that is important. Important to recognize in its diagnosis. As you mentioned, it doesn't actually encompass a ton of pregnancies, so the incidence is thought to be 3 to 8%. Risk factors, so previous preeclampsia, young maternal age, primiparity, things like lupus, antiphospholipid syndrome, hypertension, diabetes, and multiparity are important risk factors that, again, are always on exams. And that it's a very complicated immunologic and vascular process.
So, Jacqueline, let me ask you, interesting, if a woman develops hypertension after 20 weeks, is there no longer a diagnosis of gestational hypertension? It's automatically preeclampsia? Or how do you differentiate between gestational hypertension and preeclampsia?
Sure. Gestational hypertension in its uncomplicated form doesn't really manifest until in like the 35, 37 weeks, so way later. So there's new onset hypertension that meet their blood pressure criteria, so like 140 over 90 or 160 over 110 for a severe range, then that's, and they have the other factors, they might have thrombocytopenia or renal dysfunction or pulmonary edema, signs of help, then that patient is probably preeclamptic.
Okay, but if it's just hypertension with nothing else, then we don't call it preeclampsia.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, but we no longer need definitively to have the proteinuria to make the diagnosis.
Yes, it's still a characteristic of preeclampsia, but you don't need it to diagnose preeclampsia anymore.
Okay, great. So, how do you think about the overview of a pathophysiology of preeclampsia?
Yeah. Again, a dense topic, but I'll try to narrow it down to just a very simplistic form, is that when the embryo and all those good things that start to form. It secretes cells and cell lines that invade the maternal decidua and make spiral arteries. And spiral arteries, all those big juicy arteries that feed the placenta. So the thought is that when there's a dysfunction in this formation of these cells that help develop spiral arteries, that results in hypoxia of the placenta. And this hypoxia can contribute to inflammatory responses that are misaligned with the placental perfusion. There's vascular remodeling that's abnormal and endothelial dysfunction. And systemically, this manifests not only at the fetal placental unit as uteroplacental insufficiency, but then unfortunately, you know, things like preeclampsia and these hypertensive issues and end organ damage associated with that.
Now, so yeah, the way, you know, I've thought about it, and I guess this is a very simplistic way, but is that essentially if the placenta isn't getting sufficient normal blood flow, it basically says, I need to make the mother's blood pressure go up to give me more blood.
That's one theory. And again, this topic is very complex, but there's also a thought that the mother has dysfunctional endothelial, and that contributes to why the placenta develops abnormally as well. So it's kind of like chicken or the egg. Is the placental dysfunction cause maternal dysfunction, or is maternal endothelial dysfunction cause placental dysfunction? So
okay, great.
It's probably a complex interplay between the two.
Absolutely. And I'm sure we could do an entire podcast just on preeclampsia. I think that's a great overview.
Like biomarkers and all those things. So yeah.
Right. So is there anything that women who are pregnant can do to prophylax against developing preeclampsia?
Sort of. So aspirin is a newer therapy. Again, it's got an effect on prostaglandins, right, which has effects on endothelial cells. So aspirin, calcium supplements, but again, that's very gray area. And then because one of the proposed mechanisms is oxidative stress, taking antioxidant supplements and those type of things. But again, that's not really hard and fast evidence-based. So nothing yet that definitely prevents preeclampsia in a large amount of patients.
Okay. And so, I mean, is there anything, women who are at high risk, you mentioned, for example, that women with lupus or other comorbidities are at high risk. Are they currently recommended to take anything prophylactically?
High-risk patients are recommended to take aspirin. Those patients with coexisting diseases are encouraged to keep those diseases, to get their appropriate therapies, keep their blood pressure under control, not allow excessive weight gain during pregnancy, things that would exacerbate the likelihood that they would develop preeclampsia later on, okay. Especially blood pressure control.
Right. All right. So what are some things we see in women who are preeclamptic? How does it manifest?
Great. So things we see, so I like to think of it as a top-down assessment. So we look at the top, the head. So what does their airway look like? And especially if it looks bad right away, if they go through 12 hours of labor on magnesium and Pitocin and this and that, it's not going to get any better. So airway. Pulmonary edema is important. So I ask my residents to auscultate the lungs, look at the oxygen saturation, make sure that that's not deteriorating. From a cardiovascular standpoint, see hypertension, your SVR goes up. There could be some effects on the heart, which I'll touch base on in a few minutes. In the hematologic category, thrombocytopenia and DIC are important things to evaluate for. Of course, HELLP, which we'll touch base on in 1 second. Again, in the renal category, proteinuria and oliguria, again, are still important manifestations. And then at the fetus level, decrease or compromise uteroplacental blood flow.
Okay. And so now you mentioned a kind of more, in some ways, I guess, more extreme manifestation of this, or maybe it's a different pathophysiology, but what is HELLP syndrome?
Sure. HELLP is, so the acronym is hemolysis, elevated liver enzymes, and low platelets. So a patient has elevated pressures and this spectrum of dysfunction after 20 weeks, then they definitely have preeclampsia with severe features. And so depending on where they're at in their labor and how the fetus looks, so is the fetus status reassuring or not? Are they favorable candidate for induction of labor? These patients, unfortunately, they need to be delivered.
Okay, and do we think of HELP as kind of just a form of severe preeclampsia, or is it really independent?
HELP is a diagnostic criteria of preeclampsia with severe features.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so it
usually
like
doesn't exist on its own, I guess.
What's that?
It usually doesn't exist on its own.
Right, you can't have HELP and not have preeclampsia.
Yes.
And is there something that is making the preeclampsia worse that, well, I guess let me put it this way. So clearly, and I'm sure we'll get to this, but preeclampsia can end in eclampsia, in eclamptic seizures. Is this kind of another branch point that is a bad place to go from preeclampsia?
Yes. And again, you have to interact with your obstetric providers to find out how they want to proceed from there in terms of delivery planning. But one of the important things is that we don't want to panic. We don't necessarily need to jam a tube in someone's mouth just because they have an eclamptic seizure. So you want to do the basic things, support the airway, get supplemental oxygen, keep the patient away from other hard objects injuring themselves, making sure we have IV access, monitor vital signs, get the baby on the monitor. And of course, we can give things like midazolam, you know, to help initiate breaking the seizure. But these patients will need a magnesium bolus and some blood pressure control.
Okay. And then how about HELP? What are we going to do for patients with HELP?
Sure. So if we can, luckily HELP is very rare, and HELP rarely gets to the degree where we can't offer any sort of labor anesthetic, which is more favorable in these patients. So if you can catch it early enough where the platelets haven't deteriorated to, like, you know, 2,000, usually we should make sure that we establish some sort of existing neuraxial. If we think that the platelets are deteriorating or the hemoglobin is going down, we should look into things like type and screening blood and like FFP and cryo and platelets to help transfuse if that were to arise.
Now, you know, we often, when we talk about platelet levels in pregnant patients, I think a lot of our obstetric anesthesia providers will say it's not an absolute level, it's
correct,
the trend. And so would you, let's say someone has HELP and at the moment their platelets are 100, but they have HELP, and so you know, are worried they're not going to be 100 for long, will you put an epidural in them or not?
Yes, definitely. If the platelets are 100 and they're not spontaneously oozing from every mucous membrane, then absolutely. I would personally feel comfortable, again, without any obvious outward signs of bleeding, maybe considering like 70,000, 75,000. Anything after that, you might want to consider something fancy like doing a thromboelastogram so you can look at the clot dynamics, and if they're full, in addition to your clinical judgment, that might be a good option just to be reassured you won't cause an epidural hematoma.
Okay. Great. So you kind of mentioned, was there anything else you want to say about eclampsia in terms of specifics?
No.
Okay. And so then how about anesthetic management of these patients? What do we want to keep in mind?
Sure. So I think the core principles, so we want to help control hypertension. Fluid restriction is still an important part of their management to get and avoid things like pulmonary edema, seizure prophylaxis with magnesium, and have a delivery plan, especially an expedited one if the mom or baby deteriorates. So again, we talked about airway. So having an airway plan, backup equipment if needed. In terms of the hemodynamics, a non-invasive cuff should be just fine. I would only consider an arterial line if I thought things were really not going well. And actually, point of care transthoracic echo was really gaining traction in these patients. Things you might see that are dysfunctional is increased LV mass, diastolic dysfunction, pericardial fluid. An important thing to keep in mind is that preeclamptic heart disease may share a spectrum of disease with peripartum cardiomyopathy. So these are these point of care tests might be useful. Just moving on, fluid management. Again, usually the recommended methodology is to go with fluid restriction unless there's something else going on. And then, as we discussed, I would advocate for epidural in these patients just because avoidance of airway and avoidance of hypertension on induction during general anesthetic is very advantageous.
All right. And why is it that we want to fluid restrict them?
Well, if you want to get into fancy things like this glycocalyx of the endothelium, but basically they have decreased oncotic pressure in leaky blood vessels. So they're more likely to have the things like pulmonary edema, just peripheral edema, generally speaking. So the accepted standard right now is to keep them on a, like, just fluids, like a KVO, or, I mean, keep vein open, sorry. Yeah. So just fluid that they need and nothing extra.
Okay.
That's the thought. I think lastly, two other things. I think you had to do general. Personally, I would recommend using video laryngoscopy, which again is, I think, gaining traction in obstetric patients to minimize any DL attempts and to prepare for a hypertensive response on induction, so not hypotension. Things that are useful to help blunt that hypertensive response, a remifentanil or beta blocker bolus like Esmolol could be useful.
Okay, great. What about if you're going to do a spinal? Do you do anything different there?
No, I don't do anything different. Again, it's very well accepted that preeclamptic, especially with the severe features, may have a less profound drop in blood pressure after spinal anesthesia. But you should absolutely consider it if you have the time to perform during any urgent procedures.
Okay, and then you mentioned before, but these patients, of course, will be on magnesium.
Yes, in the 2013 new guidelines had suggested or recommend that magnesium is maintained throughout the perioperative period. So we would have to make sure that it's still on as the anesthesia providers. So at our institution, we established that everyone on magnesium for preeclampsia has to have two IVs. So you have one IV to maintain your mag and your one free IV to do whatever, give your bolus, induce general anesthesia, however, so that you're not interfering with their magnesium regimen.
Okay, that makes sense. What do you do about their blood pressure?
Great. So the blood pressure, so the goals are to treat blood pressure within 60 minutes, within 30 minutes, so that's physically possible, especially pressures more than 160 over 110 need to be treated within these time parameters. Hydralazine labetalol, still first line. Without an IV, oral nifedipine, 10 milligrams should be used, and we should not wait to establish IV access and then give medication. So we should go ahead and give it. It may be just as efficacious as IV labetalol. And then I did just want to mention that the California Maternal Quality Care Collaborative has a preeclampsia toolkit. So anyone interested in establishing a preeclampsia protocol at their hospital should look that up.
Great. That sounds fantastic. All right. So that's in terms of treating hypertension. Do you worry about hypotension?
Of course. And I think the most common place we worry about hypotension is when the patient is laying supine. So almost all of us from like day one of residency, learn about aortal cable compression, which I pronounced right this time. And that's actually, in my reading about this, it's actually a phenomenon that's been described since like the 1920s. So it's a very well ingrained concept in anesthesiologists. And so the thought is that about after 20 weeks, the gravid uterus presses on the IVC, so the inferior vena cava, your preload decreases, cardiac output decreases, and you get a hypotensive response, and the mom has some manifestations like dizziness, nausea, vomiting. There's even case reports of cardiovascular collapse. So it's an important thing to remember. And so what do we do about that? And so, again, one of the first things we learn when in residency is that you tilt them up 15 degrees. And actually, that's surprisingly new evidence is coming out that that's not actually as effective as we think. Hmm. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just curious to hear that. Yeah.
Okay, great. So as recent as this year in anesthesiology, a article was published that looked at the fetal acid base status in moms that were either tilted 15 degrees or not during elective sections. And part of their methodology was that they did a full-dose spinal, elective C-section. Everyone got a lactated Ringer's co-load, and they did a phenylephrine infusion to maintain maternal blood pressure. And what they found that whether the moms were 15 degrees tilted or not didn't make a difference at all in terms of how the baby came out, and meaning their fetal acid base status. So it didn't affect the fetal placental unit at that micro level. Secondly, two MRI studies that also looked at IVC volume found that at 15 degrees of tilt, IVC volume didn't change at all. And you need almost 30 degrees to even get some increase in IVC volume, which you can imagine is sometimes not clinically feasible to tilt someone, especially our obese patients, 30 degrees. That's a lot of med student lifting.
Yes.
So this thought of left uterine displacement in this 15 degrees is not necessarily clinically accurate anymore. But when do we do need to be worried about aortal cable compression? What important areas during maternal cardiac arrest? So we want, during that situation, obviously we want to make sure the heart is getting as much preload and venous return as possible. So SOAP, which is Society of Obstetric Anesthesia, and the AHA published a consensus statement, and they recommend during maternal cardiac arrest that there's an actual left uterine displacement, either by somebody pushing it away, so pushing it to the right of the patient, or someone physically pulling it towards them. So a separate provider just to establish left uterine displacement in situations of maternal cardiac arrest.
And that's when someone's manually doing it, they're pushing it to the right or pushing it to the left?
So someone is physically pushing the uterus to the left.
Okay.
So right. Kneeling to the side of the patient or standing or what have you and physically pushing it. And in that article, there's actually like really great pictures of how to do it.
Okay, so that you can either do that or tilt them as much as possible, basically, to try to get the uterus off of the great vessels.
They actually, so in that article to maternal cardiac arrest, they actually don't recommend tilting because that can negatively affect the impact of chest compressions.
That makes sense.
Your chest compressions affecting someone who's tilted is not, sometimes again, not clinically feasible.
Great.
So they recommend manual left uterine displacement.
Okay, so manual so that you can still do effective chest compressions.
Yes.
All right. So okay. Is your practice not in cardiac arrest, but in your, you know, everyday woman delivering, for a C-section, do you do 15 degrees still, or have you guys moved to doing more?
So I will still say that, again, even in my own residence and our practice here, it's still very much a reflex that the mom gets displaced some degree of left tilt. However, we adopted using phenylephrine infusions to maintain maternal pressure. So between that and making sure the mom has an adequate IV access with fluid running in, it's not really necessary in an otherwise healthy person to do left uterine as long as the maternal hemodynamics are being addressed and stabilized. But I think if there's any, so if there's an unexpected fetal decel or fetal bradycardia, yes, we will do left displacement, right, oxygen, treat blood pressure, treat hypotension, call our obstetric providers. That is still something we should do. So we shouldn't completely abandon it. And then, again, just to reemphasize that point, during maternal cardiac arrest, left uterine displacement as opposed to tilt is the recommended treatment.
Okay.
Management.
Great. So another thing that comes up a lot is gastric contents and risk of aspiration with patients at term. How do you approach that?
Yeah. That's a great question. Again, this is going to be its own pro-con discussion. But one of the thoughts is that right after 20 weeks of gestation or sometime in the second trimester, that either mechanical movement of the lower what's that sphincter at the end of your stomach?
The lower esophageal sphincter, yeah.
Lower esophageal sphincter becomes mechanically displaced, and progesterone, which is to blame for everything, confers increased risk of aspiration of gastric contents. So I agreed. What should we do with that? So probably for elective non-obstetric procedures, so if a mom is having a lap appy at 27 weeks of gestation. Sure, she probably should get aspiration prophylaxis regimen, a consistent H2 blocker, Reglan, and a non-particulate antacid. So that is generally a well-accepted way to treat these patients. What's new in this topic, though, is that the ASA and ACOG, sorry, American Society of Anesthesiologists, and ACOG, American Congress of Obstetric and Gynecologists, kind of relaxing their stance a little bit on strictly being NPO during labor. So their recommendation is that low-risk patients at low risk for going to the operating room probably can have some small amount of clears, so like juice, Jello, you know, things that are clear like that, and that prior to elective section, again, otherwise healthy moms can probably have some sort of clear beverage up till 2 hours before. Where it gets dicey is patients may have risk factors for increased risk of aspiration. So your morbidly obese patients with diabetes, patients you know of difficult airways or potential difficult airway, or again, they have a high likelihood of having an operative delivery. So again, if their fetal category status is 2/3, they probably should be MBO, and that needs to be addressed on an individualized basis.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. I remember we used to give everybody Bicitra, just kind of everyone who was, certainly everyone going for C-section got it, and sometimes anybody getting an epidural got it. Is that something you guys do?
Have you ever tasted Bicitra?
I did. It was kind of something we all had to do, initiation to OB anesthesia.
Exactly. So I often ask my residents that if I don't think it's necessarily indicated, because it tastes pretty disgusting, not to put too fine a point on it. So our current practice is that, again, if they're otherwise healthy, non-actively vomiting, don't have these other important risk factors for aspiration, we don't give it as a routine. If I had someone coming in with a significant history of GERD and they throw up every day from their pregnancy and they also have a hiatal hernia or something like that, well, then they'll probably get some Bicitra. So I try to make it, if I'm going to give something that tastes obnoxious, have a really good reason behind it.
Okay. So let's talk about a woman comes in at term and she has already had a C-section in the past.
Yeah.
What do we think about, can she give birth vaginally? And if so, what does that mean?
Great. So before I get into this quick topic, the two acronyms, so TOLAC is trial of labor after C-section, and VBAC is vaginal birth after C-section. So TOLAC means someone is trying to have a vaginal delivery after C-section, and VBAC means someone has successfully completed that. So they had a C-section, then had a vaginal delivery successfully.
Okay.
And so those are, I think, two important acronyms that need to be put out there before we discuss this topic. So I think one of the important things you need to know is, what is the previous uterine scar? And again, this is a characteristic I expect my residents or my fellow to know. So if, as we discussed earlier in the preterm labor section, if it was an up and down or classical uterine incision, and this lady comes in the triage and she's laboring, I know she's going right to the OR. That lady is not going to labor after a classical C-section. And that's, again, a well-accepted standard. If she's had a low transverse or fan and seal, which is that classic bikini cut incision, well, then she probably can vaginal delivery after C-section, or she can TOLAC. And the risk of rupture is actually only 1%, so it's actually fairly low. So I think things that we can do to interact with this is, again, a timely epidural. Do they need an epidural when they walk in the door if they have no pain? Certainly not. But once they're at a reasonable, once either mom wants one or they're at a reasonable course in their labor, and certainly if the fetal heart tones are not doing well, then that's a good time to discuss labor analgesia. Okay. And
No, that sounds good.
Okay. An important thing to know is that no matter what, if you have a regular low density local anesthetic regimen for your labor epidurals, that will not mask signs of uterine rupture, right? Which is the most catastrophic outcome of these type of deliveries. So often the classical description is that the mom feels like pain above and beyond what the epidural will cover. So that should be worrisome to us. A deterioration in the fetal heart tones, again, why it's important to know baseline. And then a classic sign is recession of the fetal parts. So meaning if the baby was at station zero, meaning they were kind of midway through the pelvis, and they shoot back up to -3, so they're way back into the pelvis, that might be a sign of uterine rupture.
Okay. And so that obviously is a catastrophe if it happens. And we want to avoid it if possible, but it sounds like you're saying that it doesn't. You can have an epidural in place; it won't, as long as you have a reasonable block and you're not overdoing it. It's not going to block that increase in pain.
That's correct. But I think it's important, especially patients that are trying to TOLAC or trying to have a vaginal delivery after C-section, and they don't want a labor epidural. that's their prerogative. However, I think they need to know, like, what would be our plan in emergency should we encounter that 1% of uterine rupture. So, I mean, the patient needs to be well-informed, the obstetricians need to be well-informed, and then we need to have a plan in place for that. So an airway plan, hemorrhage plan, things like this.
Okay, and you probably want all of your necessary personnel available to do a C-section if you need to.
That's correct. So, again, where it becomes a little bit tricky, if, for example, you work at an institution where the OB provider, even the anesthesia provider, doesn't have to be in-house and you have one of these high-risk deliveries, Tolac, so how do you navigate that? What are the medical legal complications? So that's something to consider when you're going out to look for a job.
Okay. And what about multiple gestation? What's the difference, or what do we need to think about in a woman who's pregnant with twins or more?
That's great. So I think we need to know a couple of things. Again, neuraxial anesthesia is helpful because even if, for an example of twins, even if both of the fetuses are head down or vertex and they both can be delivered vaginally, there's always a chance that once the first twin is delivered, the second twin can either have a deceleration, can change its fetal position so it's not head down anymore. The uterus can contract down unexpectedly, and then the baby is unable to be delivered. So an emergency can happen really at any time. So we need to be prepared for that. So a well-working epidural is useful. We need to be ready for an emergency section at any point during delivery. And we always deliver these patients in the operating room. I don't know if you wanted to speak to your experience at your institution, but...
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't do any OB anesthesia here, so I'm not sure.
Sad.
I know I miss it from when I was a resident. I always liked it. But so I'm not sure what our practice is, but it's interesting that you do them always in the operating room. It seems to make sense in case, as you say, any difference arises that needs to be kind of dealt with quickly with twin B.
Exactly. And then lastly, there's always a risk of uterine atony because the uterus is greatly distended because of two fetuses. It may have trouble contracting back down. So, again, having a plan for that, for example, if the patient has contraindication to your second-line agents, you want to make sure that's established before you head to the OR for your natinee instead of at the time, like looking through your sheet, trying to find out what her allergies are. So you want to have these things that are well delineated already.
That makes sense. All right, so lots of great stuff to keep in mind, and this is just part one. We've got another part to come on another day. Anything you want to wrap up with, Jacqueline, in terms of part one of issues with term labor?
Sure. I think just my overall take-home point is not only having awareness of our own anesthesia plans, certainly that's important, but I think adequate communication with our obstetric providers really provides a lot of insight into what we can do to help mitigate disasters instead of add to them. So really every day I touch base with them 4 or 5 times a day, all the time. And I'm always like asking, like, what are we doing? What's this patient up to? Like, how are the tones? And I always try to find out more information than my residents because they should know more than me. And really it makes us a better team between me and my residents, a better team between me and the OBs. And really that confers patient safety. So if I had to say one thing at the end, that's my take home point.
I think it's a great point. Fantastic. Well, Jacqueline, thanks so much for coming back on the show. Look forward to having you back on soon.
Yes, thanks for having me again.
All right. That's it for today. Another great podcast with Dr. Jacqueline Galvin. If you have any comments, go to the website, acrac.com. That's ACCRAC.com. Leave your comments so everyone can learn from your comments. You can tell us if you approach the care of term pregnant women the same way that Dr. Galvin laid out, or if you have anything different that you do that you'd like to share. If you have any questions directly for me, you're welcome to email me at acrac@acrac.com. You can get this episode as well as every other one on the website, accrac.com, where you can also join our mailing list in the upper right-hand corner. If you are a fan of the show, please take a minute, even if you've already done it, and go to iTunes. Leave a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. Also, if you're interested in helping support the making of the show, you can go to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even just a dollar or two makes a big difference in helping support the cost of the show and keeping it free, which we definitely want to do. All right. Thanks for listening. for the ACRAC podcast and Dr. Jacqueline Galvin. I'm Jed Wolpaw. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.